it was scheduled to be a celebratory event as the port returns to its home after 2 years of being absent. And our opening would be after a celebration last night of the entire building having been renovated after 11 years of work. As you all know, we, the country, are not in a celebratory mode or mood, and therefore our introductory remarks this morning celebrating the opening of court and the opening of the courtroom will be postponed for a better time. We join the state government and the federal government and the people of the country of returning to as normal work and normal operations as possible, showing that we will not be defeated by others or by ourselves. So I would ask for a moment of silence in which we mourn the dead, hope for the recovery of the ill. Our thoughts are with the families. We are angry at senseless carnage, and we're resolved to stop violence here and abroad. Friends and relatives in New York City, that they are safe, and my family is. But many are not. I will call the first case, 00-1086 CR, State v. Raflick. Mr. Fitzgerald, represent Mr. Raflick.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Fitzgerald, and I'm here on behalf of Sharice Raflick today. I'm also here on behalf of my partner, Craig Albee, who briefed this matter. He was planning on arguing it today. He is occupied in a trial in Milwaukee County that has gone on much longer than expected, in part because they were not able to work yesterday. It is with a profound sense of sadness that I am here today as well. I told Ms. Clark yesterday I was having a very hard time focusing on getting prepared for today. So I'll fill in and I'll do the best that I can. I hope my efforts reflect the importance of this case to Ms. Raflick and to everybody. But that seems hard to focus on at this moment. In any event, what we have here is a situation where the parties agree that the process and the statute for applying for a search warrant was violated, 968.12. The question is the remedy. We say this was a significant violation of the search warrant application procedure that requires suppression. The state says it is more technical in nature, and an after-the-fact reconstruction hearing by the trial court judge, as happened in this case, can remedy any violation. Now, we, from our side, agree that not all technical violations of Chapter 968 and the search warrant application process should result in suppression. What might some of those things be? Well, there were two of them in this case. In this case, the search warrant bore the name of the issuing judge. The judge who ultimately issued it was the Honorable Annette Ziegler. The search warrant actually had the Honorable Leo Schlafer's name on it. Perhaps that was due to some confusion given the hour at which the warrant was applied for and the fact that it was done over the telephone. We also, in this case, have a search warrant that doesn't reflect the time that it was executed as required by statute. Again, those are the types of technical defects that, although required by Chapter 968, we don't assert should require suppression. What we have here is, at least in my view, a complete breakdown of the process in applying for a warrant. We have a complete failure to record the telephone application process, and although everybody agrees that did not happen intentionally, that that was a mistake made by the police, it's our position that there really are no cases that we are aware of, state or federal cases analyzing the similar Rule 41, which uphold a search in a situation where a warrant application process or application completely goes unrecorded. There are some cases in the briefs of both parties where at least some of the process was recorded in some manner, either in writing or by virtue of a recording device. The Stephanson case, only the oath went unrecorded. The Rome case, which was a federal case, there was some conversation between the magistrate and the police officer before the formal application took place. That went unrecorded. The Hiddle case was similar. There was a partial recording in that case, but not a complete failure to have any type of record made contemporaneously with the application for the search warrant. So we think here we have something really completely different. Certainly, when one looks at Wisconsin case law, there's not much guidance on this. And when looking at cases from other jurisdictions, really a situation that is most extreme, where nothing that occurred when the warrant was applied for in either written form or in recorded form.
Mr. Fitzgerald, how do you distinguish the case from the Fifth Circuit, the Richardson case, and the case from the Sixth Circuit, the Char case? Those seem to be very similar situations, both situations where the good faith exception was applied. How is this situation any different than those cases?
There is no doubt that some of those federal cases in general, and particularly those two, are against us. I plan on talking about good faith here today toward the end of my remarks, but I think there are some real practical problems with this type of rule that those federal cases may not have fully analyzed. And if I could just articulate those now, what I see, and I am the lawyer who handled this in the trial court, although I didn't take part in the briefing. I am the lawyer who handled this in the trial court at the suppression motion. And one of the things that occurred to me that was really troubling was the possibility, although only 18 hours had gone by the time this thing was reconstructed, that memories could have faded in that period of time. And it may be a situation where an officer, meaning well, may be trying to reconstruct this in his or her mind. And after sleeping on it and coming to court the next day, may really believe that that's what he told the judge the night before, without any intent to undermine the process. And I don't know that you can draw a line and say 18 hours is too long or 18 days is too long. I don't know where that line is drawn.
Well, don't you have a situation here where not only is the detective describing what occurred, but the assistant district attorney is saying, yes, that's my recollection also. What has been put on the record is accurate. And the issuing magistrate, Judge Ziegler, is saying, yes, the affidavit presented to me and your testimony here today are an accurate reflection of what occurred yesterday. So you've got three different people all on the record saying that they believe that what has been recited and what's in the affidavit as well is accurate. So doesn't that take away the concerns that you have?
There's no doubt about that. All three participants in the process reconstructed it according to the record to the best of their ability.
Did they do it independently or when they were all together?
We don't know that. And that's a very difficult decision that I had to make in the trial court level. We did not have an evidentiary hearing in this case. One of the problems with allowing a reconstruction, as was outlined in the brief, is it does open the door to the possibility of judges testifying. And I decided not to do that in this case. And I did that because I thought Judge Ziegler actively participated in the reconstruction hearing. She certainly did not sit by passively and allow Mr. Martins and the police officer to make the record. She actively took part in the questioning of the police officer. I thought the record was adequate for Judge Schlafer and for appeal if necessary. And I didn't think that there was much that she could have added had we put her on a witness stand, and it was 8 months later. But to get to what I think is a bigger problem, if you allow a reconstruction after the fact, it is the, even subconsciously, the interest that the prosecutor, that the police officer, and maybe even the judge, although I would agree to a lesser extent the judge, have in affirming what went on when the warrant was issued. We have a case here now where these people have been arrested. Drugs have been found. Charges are going to be issued. And I think it's human nature that people involved in the endeavor of law enforcement at that point would have a hard time remaining neutral. I had a case one time.
Can I just ask a question, Charles? So your position is really a bright line. No reconstruction. Absolutely none. No matter whether it's 1 hour, 19 hours, or 3 months. So you want this court to adopt a bright line rule where there never can be any reconstruction, period. That is what I think you're advocating.
We would say after the search warrant is executed, yes.
Yes, which would always be.
I think there may be some room for a reconstruction prior to that, but after the search warrant has been executed and the fruits of the search discovered, then I think a real can of worms opens. I was going to tell an anecdote from my own personal experience. I had a case one time that was litigated in federal court involving a search, a profile search at the airport in Milwaukee, involving a Milwaukee County Sheriff's deputy. And he had detained some drug couriers and told them, secured them in an office at the airport, and then he went downstairs to get their baggage. Ostensibly to bring it upstairs to ask them the consent that it be searched. He, and I'm telling you what is a matter of public record after several evidentiary hearings, he went down to the baggage area, he ordered a baggage handler to stop. The baggage handler was moving bags from one plane to another. He ordered the baggage handler to take the bags off of the cart, he put them on the ground, and he opened all of them. In the suitcases were hundreds of pounds of marijuana. The baggage handler, who we located and testified in federal court, indicated at that point that the officer began to celebrate. He let out a whoop. He did some type of celebratory dance. And this witness was right out of Central Casting, Air National Guard, college student. And he testified. He told the federal judge what happened in that baggage room. The bags were sealed up or secured, they were taken upstairs to the baggage room, and then the rest of the details are really irrelevant. But I think some of the cases reflect that reality, that after a search warrant has been executed successfully, the adversary process kicks in. Now, judges are human beings, but are probably more immune from that than the people involved in law enforcement and prosecutors. There's no doubt about that. But the last thing that really troubled me about this case when I read the reconstruction hearing transcript was the series of leading questions that Judge Ziegler asked the officer at the hearing. I thought after Mr. Martins was done with the direct examination, there were still two gaps in the record in terms of probable cause. One was the reliability of the hearsay declarant. The second one was a nexus between a garage and a house, the garage being where some marijuana was seen, and a house being the location that the police wanted to search. And Judge Ziegler, at the end of the direct, what I will call the direct examination by the DA, really filled in those gaps for the state. There's really no doubt about it. And she did it really by a series of leading questions. Rather than asking the detective, why do you believe the citizen informant to be reliable, she said that, and I'm reading from the transcript, okay, and based on your conversations with the landlord, Mr. Wyderick, did you find him to be someone that was reliable and would have information in this regard? The witness, yes, I did. The court, okay, and so basically you had reason to believe what he was telling you, right? That's correct. Okay, and so you think that along with the items you saw in the garage, there will likely be items in the residence. Answer, that's also correct. The officer had seen some items in an unattached garage. He said he wanted to search the house. And when Mr. Martins was done with the direct examination, any kind of nexus between the garage and the house was still missing from the record. Judge Ziegler really filled that in at the end of the hearing again.
So what should the judge do, if anything? As I gather it, your position, and I could say looking at MAP, which was 66, which was the reason for the exclusionary rule, was to deter police conduct. What should, I think your position is the judge should not participate, or the inference is if the judge does participate, he or she should ask no leading questions.
Yes.
And so the questions you would have asked would have been not.
If such a hearing is held, it would be our position that the judge either not participate in it by asking questions, because, in fact, she's a potential witness. He or she is a potential witness. Or, certainly at the most, non-leading questions. Mr. Detective, why do you believe this person to be reliable? Or really more appropriately, what did you tell me last night about why this person is reliable? Detective, do you remember what you told me last night about why you think that what you saw in the garage gives you probable cause as an experienced police officer to search the house where so far nothing has been seen? That's incriminating.
Would it have been improper for the issuing magistrate or judge to ask these sorts of questions in a testimonial search warrant application?
Would it be proper in an application to ask those questions? Certainly in counties where oral applications are common, like Milwaukee, I've read transcripts where judges have asked questions.
And they're leading sometimes.
Not to the extent that I saw in this case, Your Honor, where at least my read of that transcript, these were not foundational type questions to move this thing along. These were plugging in holes that were required to establish probable cause. And again, the difference here after the fact is if questions are going to be asked, what they really should be is, what did you tell me last night about that? If we're trying to reconstruct what occurred at 6 p.m. last night, I think the questions are inappropriate unless they're phrased in a way to take the witness back to that time frame, because what we're really trying to do is reconstruct people's memories of what occurred the night before, the day before, or the week before.
Counsel, it seems to me, looking at the statute, you have the issue of technical irregularities, whether or not this indeed is a technical irregularity, and whether or not it affects a substantial right, a technical irregularity not affecting the substantial rights. One of the problems I have, and I'm not sure it makes any difference, and I ask you, the fact that this is an ex parte hearing, Perry, one of the leading cases that deals with reconstruction, doesn't seem to contemplate an ex parte hearing. What, if any, significance to your analysis is the nature of this ex parte hearing?
Certainly most of the cases relied on by the state to justify a reconstruction hearing are cases that took place in the context of the adversarial process, reconstructions of trial transcripts and the like. As a lawyer, I can take part in that reconstruction process. I can challenge it through cross-examination of witnesses or through my own recollection if I have to, whether that's voir dire, whether that's direct examination or anything else that occurs in a trial or a contested hearing.
Was the defendant arrested by this time? I just don't recall.
They both were. They both were. They were both present at the home when the warrant was executed.
Now,
I felt, when I litigated this case in the trial court, I honestly felt I really didn't know. I couldn't really get a firm grip on what happened that night when the warrant was applied for. Even assuming everybody's acting in good faith, I mean, even assuming nobody is trying to undermine the process, the fact that it seemed to me the detective didn't remember much about what happened that night, it seemed to me the judge had to really help him out in that regard, and it really troubled me and made me wonder what exactly happened that night on the telephone. And did the fact that a significant amount of marijuana was found when the warrant was executed influence well-meaning people into reconstructing it that way? I don't know, because I wasn't there. In Perry and some of these other cases, at least I have an opportunity, if need be, to challenge that, either as a witness or through meaningful examination. We get to good faith and the Eason case, which just came out, obviously. We have asserted that this is both a statutory and a constitutional violation.
How does it become a constitutional violation? It doesn't say it has to record it. In many states, it's not recorded, is it?
It's not, and the Fourth Amendment certainly doesn't say that. We believe that it's inherent in this statute, that the statute is part of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence and legislative enactments in this state.
Well, the way I heard your argument, I think that it is that it's inherent in your right to challenge probable cause, and you can't do it without a transcript.
If the court were to find that to be a constitutional violation, then I would suggest a remand for an Eason hearing, a good faith plus hearing, would be appropriate. I would like to question this detective on what training and experience he had in using telephonic warrants. I would like to know from the prosecutor what procedures were in place to make sure mistakes like this wouldn't occur. I would like to know from him what experience he had in telephonic warrants.
Okay, well, I have a question for you, what I want to know for the moment. And that is, as I read your briefs, your line of attack is you want suppression.
Correct.
And that you don't want to go back for hearing. You think that this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, is a violation of probable cause, because you don't have a basis. Now, if I'm wrong, that's right. That's your first line of defense. And your second line, if I hear you right, is that should we find that the good faith Leon exception comes in here, then you want to go back and have an adversarial type hearing. And if there's any other construction, reconstruction in other cases, that's what you want.
Or an Eason hearing in the trial court, yes.
And the Eason hearing, you would like a right to question the officer, the judge, anyone else who was on the telephone line?
The Washington County Sheriff's Department, who provided the phone line, telling the detective that it was recorded and telling Mr. Martins that it was recorded.
All right. That's only if you lose on your first line of attack, I assume.
Counsel,
why is Eason applicable? It seems to me Leon and Eason are all good faith cases. In one case, is that right?
Yes.
And in good faith, it's a legal issue. And it's not so easy to tell whether it's good faith, and you get a court will split 6-1 or 4-3. And you may have 6 judges or 8 judges on this case, or 12 with the Court of Appeals, whatever number, and they may divide. You know, if you looked at it 6-6, 4-3, or 6-1, or 7-0, here will take the day, right? So you say to the officer, hey, we can't put you on the spot to determine probable cause, right? But the cases we have this morning are both not probable cause. So you think Eason and Leon apply at all?
They may not, but if the court finds this to be a constitutional violation, that seems to me to be the direction we're headed. And if that is so, then I think that type of evidentiary hearing is appropriate.
Adversary.
Yes.
I'm sorry I interrupted Justice Bradley.
You've been speaking about a violation of the statute, and the statute deals with search warrant, Fourth Amendment issues, and a constitutional violation. It isn't clear to me, are you also asserting a due process violation for lack of meaningful ability to review? I mean, that sounds, the state says that's what this case is all about. In their brief, they say the right being asserted that was violated is a meaningful right to review. What's your position?
I don't think we framed it in those terms, at least with respect to due process, but I think it's inherent in our Fourth Amendment argument, in our statutory argument, that type of meaningful review, even by a judge who has to review the probable cause finding, is really undermined when there's no contemporaneous record made. That's something that affects not only the litigants, but the court as well, and ultimately undermines the ability of the court to review the probable cause finding made by the issuing magistrate.
Well, if it's a meaningful right to review, that's a state constitutional issue, too, because as I understand some of the old cases, there's a constitutional right in the state for one review, one appeal. And then you say, well, you didn't get it here because you don't have a record. You don't have a record because you don't have the transcripted conversation. And that doubles back, if you wanted to double back, into probable cause that you can't determine probable cause, which is a federal constitutional issue. That's how I read your argument.
Yes. My time is up.
Well, thank you, counsel. I'm sure on behalf of the court, we understand the trouble of focusing. The court also had, personally, that same issue, but they usually do this at the end of the oral argument, but I don't think you have to worry about the quality of your argument.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the state, the plaintiff respondent in this case. There's no dispute that there was a violation of the terms of the statute since no recording was made of this request for the search warrant. And as counsel for Ms. Raflick has said, the question is what the remedy is then. The state submits that suppression is not the remedy in this case. First of all, for the statutory violation, this court and the Court of Appeals here has said that you don't suppress evidence for violation of statute unless some statute expressly provides for suppression, and there is no such statute that does that. So I think then we have to move on to the question of whether there's a constitutional violation. The state also submits there's no Fourth Amendment violation. There's a series of cases we've cited in a brief where federal courts and other state appellate courts have held that there's no Fourth Amendment requirement that the request for a search warrant be put in writing, whether it be an affidavit submitted or transcript made, that there's no Fourth Amendment requirement that transcript be put down in writing before the warrant is issued.
You think there's a requirement, constitutional requirement, that the meaningful review be accorded for the decision of probable cause?
I think that comes up in Perry. The court referred to a constitutional right to review. That can be addressed and that can be provided through reconstruction of the proceedings. And that's why we think that reconstruction is permissible here. Not a Fourth Amendment violation. What we have to be concerned about is the right of review. And under Perry, the right of review can be satisfied if you can reconstruct the record. And I think, looking back at my brief, I don't think it was as clear as it should be as to how exactly that reconstruction proceeding should be in this context. In Perry and De Leon, they had a reconstruction proceeding for trial. This is not a trial, it's somewhat different. So I guess what I propose is to try and adapt that to a challenge to a search warrant this way. I mean, it's going to come up in the context of a motion to suppress. And then they're going to find that there's no written form showing the probable cause, because in this case it was not put in writing, the recording was lost, it was not made. I think then the burden shifts to the state to prove by a preponderance of the evidence what was told the magistrate, to show what the magistrate considered when deciding there was probable cause.
Now that's a dispute, I gather, between the defendant and the state as to whether the burden of proof should be preponderance of evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt. You take the position as preponderance because that's the standard in a suppression, right? And beyond reasonable doubt is the standard ultimately at trial.
Correct.
Any cases on that?
I didn't find any on this, the preponderance of the standard in this exact question, but the Matlock case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, said in suppression cases in a context of a Fourth Amendment case that the standard review or that the burden of proof standard is preponderance of the evidence. And then in a Miranda case, this court said in Armstrong, another suppression hearing, that it's preponderance of the evidence. So that's why we rely on that standard.
When the state errs in this manner, do you think it should increase the standard then to put the higher burden on the state since the state's error?
Well, the statute also says the recording, I think the burden stays the same. And it would, it's the same question come up even if the police department wasn't at fault. The statute says the recording can be made by the person making the request for the search warrant or by the judge. So you could have a situation where the judge is taking responsibility and the judge's recorder doesn't work or it's damaged or something. And the state would not be at fault there. So I think it's that the standard is the same either way. Then at the suppression hearing where the state would have to show this, as a practical matter, I think the state would be calling the police officer and the magistrate. And then I think the suppression hearing judge is going to have to decide whether a reliable record can be made as to what the magistrate was told.
Now we're in a motion to suppress. There's adversarial counsel present, right? Obviously. So the state calls the police officer and magistrate. That could be the judge, right?
Right.
So who's presiding over this motion to suppress?
This suppression hearing, now we're the trial court proceeding. I mean, it's before the trial court.
That the same judge that issued the warrant?
Well, if it's the same judge, I think they're going to have to probably have, it's probably best to have a different judge. Although, again, under the Perry standard, Perry is speaking in terms of trial courts, and there the judge who presides over makes the ultimate decision. Also, in Solberg, this in a different kind of context, the judge who conducted the in-camera proceeding simply and then made the decision on what to do with that material, summarized what he learned in that in-camera proceeding, and then that was the way that record was made, and this court said that that was sufficient to provide a record to determine that the judge exercised his discretion properly.
What's the state recommending? Different judge or same judge?
Well, different judge. That'll be consistent because most suppression, I think most of the time, it's going to come up where the trial judge is different, or at least a large number of times.
Except maybe in a single judge county.
Right.
Okay.
But to be consistent, the different judge. Right. And then I can see at least five factors, and this is not meant to be an exhaustive list because different cases can make them present different things. Five things that judge could consider, the suppression hearing judge could consider, in deciding whether the state had made this showing by preponderance of the evidence. One is the length, and some of these are quite similar to the standards in De Leon and Perry. The length of the missing portion in relation to the entire warrant request. Sometimes here's the entire request, sometimes maybe only part of it. The time between the application was made and when it was discovered that there was that hadn't been recorded, so that we'd lost the record. Whether the witnesses made a record of the warrant request soon after the request was made, when the facts were fresh in their memories. I think that certainly sends the credibility. In this case, it came back just a few hours later. Certainly that they're going to remember more than if it was discovered 4 or 5 months later and they have to try and recall it then. And the availability of the witnesses, the magistrate and the officer to testify. And then I think also how complicated the warrant request was. I mean, some of these can be, you have to tie together several different strands of information that can be complicated. Others, like this one, and it was fairly simple, and some were even more simple than this one. I think all those should be taken into account. And as to reliability, I mean, this case, I think, is quite similar. The situation may come up under the hearsay exception for recorded recollection, where the person shows up to testify months after an event. They may not remember exactly what was said or what was done at that event, but if they made a record of it very soon after the event, that document, and then they can say, testify to the reliability of that document, that document is admissible for the substance of this show what happened. This would be this case, I think, would be a good example of but that had to be applied because the magistrate or the officer made that record within hours after the warrant request when memories were fresh. And they, at the time of suppression hearing, which was, I believe, 8 months later, they may not remember the details, but they could say, we remembered it when we made that transcript.
Mr. Kleinmeier, are you relying at all on the approach of the good faith exception from Eason and the two federal cases, Richardson and Char?
We didn't hear for a couple reasons. One, I thought this reconstruction procedure should be applicable under Perry and so forth. Also, for here, the reason there's no recording is the Germantown Police Department told the DA and the deputy applying that the line was going to be recorded. The next day, the Germantown policeman servant said, nope, that didn't get recorded. And the record doesn't really show why. I don't know if somebody just made a mistake and the line was never recorded, or if that line was normally recorded and there was a breakdown in their equipment that night. I mean, without a record to show more precisely why there was no recording, I thought it'd be hard-pressed to make a good faith under these particular facts.
Does the fact that the magistrate has some responsibilities under the statute where there is the approach of recording the proceedings, does that enter into this at all?
I don't think in this particular case, because police department took the responsibility to make the recording. I certainly think if it's a situation with a judge said he or she was going to make the recording, and then there was a problem. I think that certainly that for the state's point of view is a stronger basis for making a good faith argument.
Well, the statute says that, as I understand it, that either the magistrate or the person requesting this type of proceeding is supposed to be sure that things are being recorded. And then secondly, it says that the judge, or the magistrate again in this particular case, is to order a transcript of the proceedings. So there is some responsibility in the magistrate and also in the requesting attorney. Is that not correct?
That's correct, yes. I just think in this particular case, since the police, the DA and the deputy sheriff and the Germantown Police Department took the responsibility of making the recording, in this case, I didn't think I could make the argument that then they should be relying on a judge to make the recording, since they took the responsibility here. That's why I'm saying a different set of facts, I think I might well be in the arguing that, you know, if the judge said, I'm making the recording and everybody's relying on that, and then the judge's equipment fails or whatever, I think that the police should be able to rely on the fact they were told that.
Are you bothered at all by the fact that the judge was, Judge Ziegler, the magistrate, was an active participant in the reconstruction?
Not in the context of what the problem is here. I mean, I think the fact the judge was asking leading questions shows, it is additional proof, good proof, that she was told that information the night before. I mean, if she's asking leading questions and providing the officer with information, how would she know that if she hadn't been told that the night before? So I think in this particular context, and whether trying to reconstruct something that happened the day before or in the past, in fact, anything that shows that the judge was aware of it provides credibility that that was told to her when the warrant request was made.
And I ask this of your opposing counsel, does the ex parte nature of this reconstruction hearing bear upon the analysis at all? Perry didn't address the ex parte. Oftentimes it's not having a trial transcript, and then you have a opposing counsel there, and everyone can reconstruct. Here you have...
I understand that there's a difference that I can see as a very significant difference. I think that's addressed in the fact that the procedure proposed at the suppression hearing, the defense attorney had a chance to cross-examine both the officer and the magistrate to see the basis for their recollection. And also I think that was addressed in the state of Washington cases, the Meyer and Smith cases, where to reconstruct a warrant request in that state, it's not enough for the police officer to testify. You also have to have, they say, a neutral person, being the clerk or the magistrate. I think is with the way they help get around that problem, because the magistrate does not have, you know, a stake in the outcome. I don't think, just because I think the magistrate issued the warrant when it was requested, I don't think places the magistrate in a situation where he or she is going to tailor their testimony to cover it later.
One of the things that bothered me, help me with this if you can, to say that a judge asked leading questions is a pretty, no big deal. Judges ask leading questions. When I read this transcript, it seemed to blur an innocuous leading question with really being adversarial. That's the way that it came off the page to me. And that's one of my concerns. Is the court in this instance playing the role of an adversary as opposed to the required neutral magistrate in the reconstruction?
Well, I don't think it is, again, in the context here where I don't think the judge or the magistrate is really in the role that the judge or magistrate is normally in. Here they're trying to determine what happened the night before, and the judge, I think, was also trying to put in her recollections or have it reflect what her recollections were. I mean, at the end of the hearing, she made the statement that, I think we've now got everything on the record that happened. This is all consistent with what I remember. So I think in this particular case, the judge was probably making through the officer's testimony, helping make the record of what happened the night before. I think we have to remember that I'm not aware of this ever happening before. I mean, I didn't come across any cases from Wisconsin anywhere where this kind of thing had to be reconstructed. And in Washington, again, they want the judge's testimony. In the Smith case from Washington, what they recommend is a footnote near the end of the case recommending the proper procedure, which was not done there because when they came to the suppression hearing, the judge was trying to recall what happened, I think it was like 4 months before, it couldn't. which is pretty natural. And so the suppression motion was granted in that case. But in a footnote, the procedure that was recommended was, if you don't discover the missing telephone transcript until after the search warrant's been executed, first thing you should do is immediately notify the judge. The judge can make notes of what she was, he or she was told when the warrant was issued. That's probably the better thing to do. We'd have independent recollections from the officer and the judge. I think here, you know, they wanted to act quickly. I think they should be given credit for acting quickly to try and get things, a record of things made as soon as possible when the memories were the freshest. It probably would have been better to do it independently. But, I mean, even under, I was checking and trying to do a little quick research on this recorded recollection hearsay rule. And in McCormick, there are some of these records are sometimes done jointly. So even under that, it's, you know, it's found to be reliable enough to satisfy hearsay rules. So the fact that this was done jointly, I don't think necessarily makes it invalid. And I think that's basically where the leading questions come from.
My concern isn't the joint as opposed to the ex parte. This person was under arrest. It makes no difference, huh, in your analysis?
Well, I think it's joint in the sense that, I mean, this...
May I interrupt? My thought is this. Even though, and I'm not sure it's a technical irregularity, but even if you would say it's a technical irregularity, having it as an ex-party process seems to affect the substantive rights.
Well, it's ex-party where the warrant request is made. This reconstruction happened to be... it's no longer ex parte at the suppression hearing. It can be cross-examination. I mean, this is really no different than, as some of these cases have pointed out, this kind of process is no different from any other factual controversy that a court has to decide. I mean, we have many times when probable cause is evaluated when there's no warrant and officers are acting on probable cause in other contexts, and the officer has had to make the probable cause determination. I mean, it's not much more different than that. The officer or state witnesses are then cross-examined at the suppression hearing. I want to make a point on this technical irregularity thing. I really don't see that the 968.22 is that significant in this case when we're talking about the remedy and whether there should be suppression. I mean, the rule independently... constitutional violation or a statute specifically provides for suppression. Well, there's no statute that specifically or expressly provides for suppression, so we're back...
Your citation to that rule?
Heckam? Heckam is one of the more recent ones. Joukowsky, which is from the Court of Appeals, is a very recent one. Verkulik is another one that gets cited a lot.
Okay.
But what is that statute if it isn't a fourth a statute that touches upon the Fourth Amendment? I mean, the title of the statute was search warrant, if I recall correctly.
Well,
I mean, you
yeah,
know.
I invite the court to check the two sources on that. One is the Platt's Law Review article, which is cited in the brief for another point. But he also that statute goes back to was adopted in 1949, and. Platts discusses that statute, and I invite the court to check the Legislative Reference Bureau file on that statute. And I think you find they said that was passed to make sure that no evidence was suppressed unless there was a constitutional violation.
So that statute, what's the purpose of that statute?
Well, as explained,
is it to codify existing Fourth Amendment jurisprudence or what?
Well, as Platts explained, they just wanted to make sure that nothing was suppressed for technical purposes. The law review articles in, I think it's the 1950 Wisconsin Law Review, at page 251, there's about a page discussing that statute. And he cites an example where a wrong address was on a search warrant, and they wanted to make sure that things wouldn't be suppressed for that purpose. And they make the point that he says, nevertheless, his last sentence discussing this, nevertheless, there is a need for legislation within the limitations that supplementary to constitutional rules, and this is the advisory committee, has attempted to provide as fully and completely as possible. I think whether just this plus the drafting file I think, indicates it's just supposed to be a legislative statement that unless there's a constitutional violation, you don't suppress it.
Well, that concerns me. That concerns me, because if you have the statute making, if the purpose is to codify Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, then that happens all the time. But my thought process is this. In Eason, we adopted good faith. Now, the legislature can adopt good faith exception, because that is constitutional. That's our bailiwick, not the legislature's. How can the legislature in 968-22 say, okay, there's a Fourth Amendment violation, but it's technical, and therefore we can address the remedy? Isn't that a kind of a separation of powers? What's the legislature doing?
I don't think they
saying, meant. What is the legislature doing, unless it's codifying existing Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, what's the legislature doing addressing the relative value of Fourth Amendment violations?
I think they were just saying that, as I understand the law review article and the drafting file, is that they just wanted to make sure that something that would not otherwise be suppressed was a constitutional violation gets suppressed because it happens to violate, you know, some small detail.
Okay.
And they cited a couple cases where courts had decided not to suppress evidence because the detail was
so
small.
That's why I talk about codifying existing Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. That's okay. No problem. But if the purpose was to do something else, that is to limit constitutional remedy, what authority, absent codification of court law, does the legislature have to limit the Fourth Amendment remedy?
I think that would take a lot of research that I'm not really prepared for. I mean, although, you know, in Easton's one of the other cases, they said exclusionary rule is a judge-made rule. I mean, I think the legislature overrules judicial decisions on many that aren't constitutional. So
tied into, but we have, there is other authority that says exclusionary rule is constitutionally based.
Well, now I don't even want to get into the whole, hope I don't have to get into the whole, like, you know, justifying the legislature on this, but I think that this just shows that it's not, it was cited in the reply brief almost to imply that the 968-22 is an exclusionary rule in itself, saying that, you know, if you violate the statute, you exclude the evidence. I don't think that's the case. The statement's over and over again, you don't exclude just for a statutory violation. I don't see any statute that provides for suppression for violating this 968-12. So we're getting back to whether there's a constitutional violation that requires suppression.
I have some questions for you. In light of the fact that the state's asking that there be adversarial proceedings, or the possibility of adversarial, and there were no such proceedings here, at least in the Reconstruction, do we have to send it back to give the defendant an opportunity to be able to question?
I guess I would certainly think that would be fair. I mean, they made the point that they didn't have a chance to cross-examine. I mean, counsel has said that it was waived. But if, you know, if these rules, if I guess from my point of view, if the state's proposal for how to do this is adopted, a procedure that was not available or known at the time, I don't think it's unfair to then let them go back and have the evidentiary hearing where they can challenge the witnesses.
So you're amending your conclusion for the reasons discussed about the state request affirmance. You really are asking it to be sent back.
So part of it, I think, is reviewing, preparing for this, and trying to be more precise on the procedure. And also in the prior brief, they mentioned that they didn't get a chance to cross-examine.
Could I just clarify
for
a moment to make sure that I understand what you're suggesting? You're suggesting that the Reconstruction hearing be adversarial with appointed counsel or retained counsel and opportunity to cross-examine? I thought you were suggesting the five-point procedure for a suppression hearing.
Yeah, that's okay. It's a good
so
question to make
clarify.
Sure I get it clarified. The Reconstruction proceeding where the judge and the magistrate went back and forth, no, don't do that over. I'm talking about the suppression hearing itself, where they introduced that transcript and the suppression judge found that the record was sufficient. And that's the hearing that I understand that counsel said he decided not to pursue an evidentiary hearing.
So you're going to allow the witnesses to get together, get it straight, make a record, leading questions, if not on the bench necessarily, so is the judge going to be on the bench when the judge reconstructs, or is it okay to do it in the DA's office, in the judge's office, behind closed doors, and with the sheriff's department, or whoever is the law enforcement officer, is that the state's position? I just didn't visualize it that way, but, you know, there's nothing the matter with witnesses talking to each other ahead of the trial. I'm just asking, what's the state's position?
Well, that's already been done here when they had no guidance as to what to do.
Yeah, because but you're giving us guidance now. And okay. And Justice Sykes is absolutely right. I was talking about reconstruction, which would be part of the motion to suppress. But she's absolutely right that there are two possibilities. And I'm asking, what's the state's?
Mine is the reconstruction proceeding, which I think was held on April. Or the day after the search warrant.
Right.
We don't. That's set. It's not. We can't do anything.
And are you advocating that it be done from the bench and with a court reporter, or are you advocating that it's like any other three witnesses be done privately?
Reconstruction proceeding. What were they? Well, it's probably as recommended in the Smith case in Washington. The best thing is to do if they just make their notes independently, the officer and the judge. I mean, but again, they had no guidance here. They just had a...
Well, if the court should take what the state proposes or something like it, I'm seeking guidance. So your guidance would be independent.
The recommended procedure pursuant to, especially like the Washington case, would be independent.
So the three of them are independent. And then they could take the stand and the motion to suppress, and one of the questions could be asked is, have you consulted with each other? And that would be part of it. Okay.
Maybe with credibility, I don't think it's going to keep...
You're indicating that this was an ex parte proceeding in open court. Would be inappropriate, or it's one way?
Well, I guess...
Just so that the chief's questions are directed to this... Yeah. This proceeding, right. The proceeding we're dealing with here.
Well, we have two proceedings.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the suppression hearing. I'm talking about the reconstruction.
Okay. Well, part of the problem being ex parte is, especially if you're going to do it immediately, right after the search warrant is executed, there may not be a defendant yet.
Right. Well, right. In this case, we're post arrest but pre-charging, right. And that makes a difference in the ex parte analysis, doesn't it? And whether it's got to be on the record with everybody present, including counsel for the defendant.
Right. I mean, I think we want them to get this stuff down as soon as possible.
And so, under those circumstances, maybe independent notes would do it. Everybody's independently makes notes and then reconstructs. What's the matter with that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Is that the preferred procedure?
Yes, I think it would be the preferred procedure.
Under the circumstances of this state, which is almost immediate, and no charges filed, and no counsel, right?
Yes.
So the position, just so I understand, the position you're taking is that the procedure in this case was inappropriate, was wrong, or the preferred procedure... Was there anything wrong with what happened here? You've had the questions as far as whether it was leading, whether this is inappropriate, whether the judge should be a participant. Based on this record and what Judge Ziegler did, do you find anything wrong with what happened in this proceeding?
No, I mean, I think it'd be reliable enough to staff to satisfy the standards at a suppression hearing. Again, it goes back... For this recorded recollection hearsay rule, you can have joint recollections. I mean, if that can be especially if that can be reliable for use later, I think this can be just as reliable. At a suppression hearing, then these people can be cross. If they're subject to witnesses later on at the suppression hearing, there can be questions that helps sort this out.
The word itself, reconstruction, means that, well, we're going to do it again as we recall it was done in the first place.
Right.
Is there a problem with doing it ex parte or in that informal way if the deficiency is discovered after charging?
Well, I guess at that point, I don't see much difference between... I think the defendant's protected by being able to cross-examine at suppression hearing. because he wasn't present at the warrant request anyway. So he's not going to be able to learn a whole lot more if they had a reconstruction hearing again, or if he asked his questions at the suppression hearing.
But counsel, a suppression hearing in a lot of courts is 6 months, 8 months later. I mean, that's just the timing of it, to me, doesn't make common sense that it's the same as, you know, hours later.
Well, if the officer and the judge make their own notes independently and make their own records independently so that they have something to rely on if they're called to testify at a suppression hearing months later, there's nothing for the defendant to attend the first time anyway. His first chance to question is at the suppression hearing.
Oh, if the, that was only my first question. Has everybody done that? If I heard you correctly, and I might not have, you said that you were not relying on the good faith exception because you don't think the evidence here is sufficient enough to support that.
Right.
Is that right? Does the state ask for a return for an evidentiary hearing on good faith?
I guess I'm not going to pass up a chance to pursue it further if we're granted a chance. I mean, it wasn't developed before, but it wasn't a good faith exception when they had the hearing before either.
And so you don't think the evidence is good enough on that? Okay,
I they'd find out.
My next question. Suppose the state had recorded this, or that if the conversation had been recorded, but they want to supplement this record as to other information that was really available. Can you do that?
I mean, introduce information
right.
that was not given to the magistrate
right.
at the time
right.
after the warrant decision?
Right.
No.
No, you cannot do that. That's a violation of the Fourth Amendment, is it?
Yes, it's just information that was available to them, the magistrate, at the time he or she issued it.
Supplemental, no reconstruction, yes, that's the state's position.
I think the difference is when we're trying to find the information that the magistrate was presented to the magistrate at the time he or she issued the warrant.
Do we have to overrule any cases if we take the state's position?
I think Glagowski presents the problem for the state. And I think that Glagowski, I think, was essentially a right of review case and more than search and seizure case because they emphasized the need to have a record for review, and they didn't limit that emphasis to warrant requests. It was just judicial actions in general.
And you don't, your state's position is reconstruction is just as good as the original taped recording?
Well, it's not just as good. As in Perry and De Leon, the question is whether you can come up with an adequate reconstruction to substitute for the transcript.
Okay. And on a reconstruction in a non-adversarial position, that's the state's position.
Non-adversarial in the sense that, yes, the defense attorney would not be there.
Again,
I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing as reconstruction. Reconstruction is when the witnesses are making the notes of what happened.
That's right.
Okay.
And the judge is being a witness in a proceeding that the judge is presiding over, the way it happened in this case.
In this case, yes.
In Wisconsin, is suppression part of our constitutional, state constitutional history?
Not the full history, because it didn't come along until the 1920s, and there was a search and seizure provision long before then. And this court has said...
It covered the state.
Pardon?
I'm sorry, go ahead. Under the state constitution.
The court has said that it's a judge-made rule. It's not a constitutional requirement. Exclusion of the evidence.
Thank you, counsel. Sorry to have kept you over. Are there any other questions? Mr. Fitzgerald?
Well, all this trying to figure out how to do this can be avoided if they just follow the statute that the legislature enacted. It's pretty simple. You can apply for a warrant by telephone. You don't have to do that in person. You can pick up a cell phone and call a judge. There's now duty judges in just about every county that are available 24 hours a day. Everybody has a cell phone now. I think this thing will increase. But just follow the statute. If you follow the statute, we won't have to have problems like this. As I was listening to the manner in which we can talk about how to do these reconstruction hearings, one thing that I keep coming back to, no matter how the court would fashion such a rule is the appearance of all of this, the appearance of partiality, which some of the cases talk about. Let's say the judge and the prosecutor and the police officer make written notes of what they remember in the application process, and those are sealed up and preserved in some way, and then turned over to defense counsel after the client is charged. Well, I've got to assess whether probable cause existed. Now I have to deal with that at a written level. And how do I know that the police officer and the DA didn't get together and get their written notes straight before they drafted them? Or even
how do you know that in the in when they originally go and get the warrant? How do you know that? How do you know that what? Okay, go ahead.
That, well, that's, I mean, I guess that's a good point. How do we know when a police officer applies for a warrant that everybody doesn't sit and chat in the judge's chambers and get, that's a good point. Again, before the evidence has been.
And most counties, by the way, counsel, don't have a duty judge. They have, I think the majority of counties are single judge counties, having come from one several years ago.
But that's a good point. We don't really know that for sure. But I think the dynamic is different before the warrant has been executed. Once the evidence has been found, I think then things change.
Counsel, does it make any difference here if the reconstruction hearing was held on August 5th, 1998, commencing at 1:23 o'clock in the afternoon, and it appears that the defendant entered a plea on August 4th, the day before. So this might have, if it is, maybe I'm wrong, if it is post-charging, the reconstruction hearing is post-charging, does that make a difference in the analysis?
I'm fairly certain the reconstruction hearing in this case was pre-charging. If we were confronted with a situation where it was post-charging, then, I mean, arguably, you have a defense lawyer who can take part in the reconstruction hearing, as I guess we've alluded to this morning.
I'm not sure that the court record that's been transmitted with the appeal is correct, because I haven't gone through the full court record, but on the face of it, it indicates it seems to me a plea on August 4th, but you don't know one way or the other. Hmm?
That would not seem to me to be correct. I think the arraignment was significantly later than that. But if there were a situation where charges had been issued and a public defender had been appointed or counsel retained, then I guess the lawyer could participate in that process. But again, it seems to me, at least from an appearance standpoint, that I have to ultimately cross-examine a judge. If I want to challenge probable cause, I have to ultimately ask a fellow judge in that county or brought in from another county to make a credibility assessment about that judge. And we think the better way to resolve this is to stick with Glodacki, articulate a bright line rule, and ask police officers and tell police officers to follow the simple language of the statute. If post-construction hearings were appropriate, the legislature could have said that and would really gut the purpose of a fairly simple statute.
Why was there such a long delay from the time that the warrant was executed and arrests were made and the suppression hearing?
Judge Schlafer's docket was such that there was a considerable lapse of time before we could get an evidentiary hearing. He had a pretty congested calendar, and that's the way it got scheduled. And ultimately, you're right, it turned out to be about 8 months before he finally ruled on this.
Well, are you implying that you tried to get an earlier suppression hearing?
No, and we filed our motions in a timely fashion. He had set a time limit for that,
And I don't recall anything unusual happening to cause an adjournment. That was the way it got calendared. And I don't recall the DA objecting to that or trying to do it any differently than the way Judge Schlaefer had calendared it.
Could you clarify for me, I think you addressed this, but there was not an evidentiary hearing at the suppression hearing.
Correct.
And why was that?
A decision that I made and the co-defendant's lawyer made that the record that we had was adequate for Judge Schlaefer to decide the motion. We thought that because Judge Ziegler had actively participated in the reconstruction hearing, we had little to gain or little to add to the record by questioning her. I frankly was uncomfortable with the notion of giving a subpoena to a sitting circuit court judge, asking her to testify before a fellow judge, and raising issues as to whether he had to recuse himself and another judge from another county brought in. Some of the things that the cases talk about, it's described as unseemly. But a big part of it, Your Honor, was we had thought that the record that she had made in terms of her participation and the questions that she had asked were sufficient for us to argue it to Judge Schlaefer and ultimately on appeal if that was necessary.
Counsel, you're correct. It was pre-charging, looking at the file.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Hearing none, that closes the hearing on 00-1086-7.